Hi, I'm Taylor Sperl.
And I'm Liz Dune.
And this is Neat. It's a weekly booze cast.
It's a history lesson with a twist.
Ooh, we got very, very important twists this week, huh?
Yeah, so this week is the same week as Repeal Day.
Oh, so this should be coming on the 2nd of December. Repeal Day is the 5th?
Yes, the 5th of December. Yes. So remember the 5th of December, because it's Repeal Day.
Yeah, that just means you can have a drink.
Yeah, it's just a celebratory. It means that Prohibition is over, but it's been over for 100 years. Yes. 100 years, forever.
That doesn't mean that you can't throw yourself a Repeal Day party. It is something you see in a lot of cocktail bars, especially in New York City. Yeah, we celebrate it.
Prohibition is kind of a hard topic to cover in one episode.
It's massive.
Yeah, so we're going to break it down. And since this is our first installment of our Prohibition series, one could say, I'm just going to give you a little bit of an overview on why Prohibition happened and kind of what went on.
So we suffer sometimes on this program of sometimes you just know things, you just assume that everybody else knows things, so we throw off terms like, oh, Prohibition, Repeal Day. Like, it's like, I just assume that other people have spent time on booze history, which is a niche, and I shouldn't do that.
Right. I mean, we don't, like, nowadays, nobody has to worry about Prohibition.
No?
Yeah, so, you know, you might not stick that in your brain if you don't need that information, but I'm here to stick it in there anyway.
All right, just stick it in there, Liz.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Okay. Wow. Okay, so there were a few causes that I want to talk about. So I'm going to give the big one to the temperance movement. Mm. You know what temperance is?
No drinking for you.
No, it's like a group of dedicated citizens deciding to put their nose in other people's business and tell them that they shouldn't be so drunk. But it's a little bit more than that, too. In many ways, the population of this land, where the United States is now, has been divided over a booze battle since the beginning of colonization in America. Think like the Puritans, you know, there's like religious piety / like thinking like drunkenness is evil. Mm. And then on the other side, not only we have people who just want to drink, but also really need to produce alcohol to make a living.
And be evil.
Right. You know, you need that evil juice so you can be evil.
It's all about the population. It's like, oh, you're exactly right. And that's why I drink.
Yeah.
I don't like even like the taste. I just want to be evil.
Sure. So the government tried to tax it pretty early on, not only to help alleviate the deficit, but also to dissuade people from drinking so much. And this was actually one of the things that Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson beefed over. Hamilton and the Federalists were into the whiskey tax because Hamilton's pretty, like, you know, he's organized. He wants to, like, use this thing to grow the economy and fix the deficit and all that. And when Jefferson's party took political power, Jefferson said, fuck that. No whiskey tax.
Right.
Fuck your whiskey tax. Fuck it. He said those words exactly.
I don't think he said those words exactly.
No?
No.
Okay.
I'm going to say that as much as I don't want to pay more than I have to for my booze, I'm going to come down on Hamilton's side there. One, because I like his musical that he made.
Right. You know the musical that Alexander Hamilton wrote?
He wrote a really good musical. And also, it's like the argument right now for, like, marijuana. It's like, it will bring a ton of money. Like, it's okay to make things that people want and then make money off of it. I think that's good for growing economies.
Yeah, absolutely. So at first, the goal of temperance was moderation. Early temperance viewed drunkenness as a disease. One of those was Benjamin Rush, who was one of the foremost physicians in the 18th century. And he wrote about the harmful effects of alcohol to the body and mind, and his writings inspired some of the early temperance groups across many states. The American Temperance Society, formed in 1828, had 1.5 million members by 1835, and women counted for 35% to 60% of that across the different chapters. And so I'm going to put into the causes of this, because it goes along with temperance, alcoholism. Alcoholism at this time was in truth a bit of a problem. In 1830, Americans consumed 1.7 bottles of hard liquor per week on average, which is about three times what the average American consumes today. Unless you work in a restaurant, then that seems about right.
Called out.
I mean, I've been there. Well, okay, so partly, okay, so why are they drinking so much back then? It's partly due to a trend in the early development of the United States where people started drinking less beer and cider and start drinking more hard liquor like rum because it becomes cheaper. And that is due to the economic impact that the institution of slavery had on those markets, including sugar production. Because if you don't pay, like if you pay your laborers nothing, then of course your production cost is a lot less. Alcoholism at this time is also taking a toll in the homes of working class and middle class women who didn't have any legal rights if their husband was drunk all the time and became abusive or spent all their money on booze, which accounts for high numbers of women in temperance organizations. Another factor is just the rise of social moralism. So after the abolition of slavery and the end of civil war, a lot of people who had been abolitionists and concerned with the social morality of the United States turned to tackling other social issues. The first one being polygamy. They were really concerned about that. And that was outlawed in the 1890s. So then after that, they could focus their efforts on temperance.
All right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then another movement that is very, very integral to prohibition happening is actually the women's suffrage movement. Married women were still held under the doctrine of couverture, which meant that when a woman married, her identity became covered by her husband's, and all of her legal rights were basically forfeited. So she couldn't own any property. She couldn't make decisions about herself or her children. She didn't own her own body. She couldn't keep her own salary. She couldn't sign any legal documents or enter in any contracts, which makes it very hard to do anything if your husband is a piece of shit, which it seems like was quite common at the time.
You know, commonly known fact. Husbands were piece of shit in the 18th century.
I mean, I guess so.
There we are, 19th century.
It's the 19th century, technically.
Well, it seems like women were more property than people.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And actually, couverture never officially ended. It just kind of phased out with the introduction of Women's Property Rights Acts. So they had a good reason to kind of jump on this temperance thing. The temperance movement gained a lot of drive from these women who had no rights at all, so all they could do was ask nicely for their husbands to stop drinking. And so then the next natural progression is that, okay, no, we need to be able to vote. We need to be able to vote because this isn't working. So in turn, temperance also gave women who wanted to push for suffrage a really good way to moralize their cause, because the women's suffrage movement was considered so radical, but if they joined a temperance organization like the Women's Christian Temperance Union, they seemed more respectable. Yeah.
So a radical ideology aligning itself with an established religious body is a good idea for gaining political leverage?
You could say that.
Okay.
You definitely could say that, for sure.
Weird times back then.
Yeah, okay. I know. Nothing like today.
Nope.
Yeah, and women's rights proponents like Susan B. Anthony and Katie Stanton, actually a lot of them started out as temperance activists. And don't get me wrong, temperance was also a pretty radical idea at the time, but when they used religion as part of it and kind of took the moral stance, it did make it more acceptable for women to be causing such a fuss about it, quote unquote. So the women were considered in society to be naturally more moral And I would say that they just had more responsibility. But and they used that widely held belief to argue that they should have the right to vote. This actually pit breweries against the women's suffrage movement for fear of losing their business. I mean, you know, like you gotta kind of follow your interests here.
You gotta watch out for number one.
Yeah, of course.
Even if it's number brew.
Yeah, number brew. Oh, I see what you did that. I see what you did
I'm sorry, keep talking.
Yeah. So Woodrow Wilson actually decided to be in favor of women's suffrage, not because, well, maybe he agreed with them, but he mostly did it in preparation of World War I, since women would have to become part of the workforce when all the guys went off to war. Right before the Volstead Act, which is what we know of as the 18th Amendment or Prohibition, right before that came into effect in January 17th, 1920, there was a wartime prohibition in an effort to save grain that took effect June 30th, 1919. So July 1st, 1919 became known as the Thirsty First.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah, so that's another thing if you want to celebrate that. I mean, or I guess pour one out for that one because it's a sad day. Woodrow Wilson tried to veto it from passing, but Congress passed it anyway. And that established the legal definition of intoxicating liquors and penalties for producing it. As we know, easily passed, not so easily enforced.
Yes.
Prohibition didn't prohibit the private possession or consumption of alcohol, which gave people who were willing to break the law a fruitful opportunity to fill the supplier and distribution role. And that's where, you know, that's where organized crime comes in, I'm saying.
So you ended people drinking and you created the mafia.
Basically. I mean, cool. They were there before.
They just got real good at stuff.
Yeah, we're going to have to make another... We're going to have to make another episode about the mob and Prohibition.
Oh, yeah. That's...
Yeah, for sure. So the stats suggest that Prohibition was successful in terms of reducing the consumption of alcohol, as well as deaths from cirrhosis of the liver and arrests for public drunkenness. Although I'm not sure we can say that's completely accurate, because how are we counting illegal booze? I don't know. And also the reduction of deaths related to cirrhosis of the liver were kind of offset by the deaths due to drinking adulterated alcohol. We've talked before, not specifically about Prohibition, but like the dangers of moonshine, like Radiator whiskey or whatever. Like, there were some things going on where like the alcohol might not be completely safe. Well, or maybe it's extremely overproof and you die of alcohol poisoning.
I mean, it's one of those situations where, because, you know, leading up to Prohibition, we didn't even have laws on the books for how to legally label alcohol percentages. People didn't really have a concept of what it meant to be drunk. Like, things were looked at differently culture-wise as far as different spirits. It just seems funny because it's like, instead of recognizing like, hey, we need to legislate this shit because we need to have rules. We need to be able to operate a society with this. We just like, nope, ban it all. And that's kind of the... It made it worse.
And then it's not regulated and then it's worse. Yeah, exactly. On the other hand, it's also been suggested that Prohibition drove the crime rates up. It really didn't, unless you count everyone being in violation of the 18th Amendment. You know.
There was a lot of crime and that people were just at their homes drinking.
Right, you know. But then again, privately consuming it was legal, but the sale of it was illegal. So
there's some loopholes.
It's probably safe to say that the claim of increased mob activity and organized crime is true, but literally everyone was involved in that, including legit businesses and politicians. So if we're going to count corruption as a crime, which it is, you know, but my point is, it's been going on forever and no one seems to care.
Well, it's an important part of the American identity. It's like
corruption.
I was going to say alcohol, but both. Both, definitely both. But yeah, if you outlaw a huge part of the American identity, like, you can try with legislation, but how are you going to stuff that back in the box?
No way.
You know, I think politicians gained favor. I mean, we're going to see this in the election coming up. It was a big election point, like, I'm gonna bring your booze back, and everyone was like, yeah, there was an undercurrent of understanding in all classes that, hey, we need to find a way to get this, and it wasn't just the criminals that were drinking.
Right, exactly. Okay, so I'm just going to like do a nod to this particular aspect because this is only our first episode on prohibition and there's a lot to cover. We're just going to skip speakeasy culture and come back to that at some point because there's just a lot.
This is the big picture that you're giving us.
Yeah. So meanwhile, women got the right to vote and continued to advance their rights during prohibition because, number one, World War I gave women a reason to hold jobs and keep their salary. There's also the advancement of technology within the home, and mass production allows for products to be cheaper, and advertisers began to target women as decision-making consumers, which wasn't really the case before. This time period also gave women from different socioeconomic classes the opportunity to advance their status, and there was this idea of the new woman, and we see a rise in popularity of first wave feminism where women were starting to have the freedom to choose their role in society, which means they don't have to be bound to the idea of duty. Yes, they could be involved in politics, but also they could decide to value their individuality. And that's where you get those flappers.
Oh, yeah.
They really like them some individuality. Although they all kind of dress the same.
They all like their individuality the same way.
Yeah, exactly. So, I think this idea is really fun to think about because you have women pretty much leading the temperance movement to get prohibition to happen. And then when they do, they're kind of like, hey, I think I like making decisions about myself. And I guess I could go party if I freaking want to.
Well, because that's something... I mean, that's, like you mentioned, we're kind of glossing over speakeasy culture, but that was a huge part of it, right? Women were drinking next to men. All types of people were drinking next to each other because they were all breaking the law.
Oh, yeah.
I kind of, like, I'm not even, like, I think that women using this as a means to an end is brilliant.
Yes, I love it. Like, as a if it was a strategy, I love the strategy.
Don't know if it was just a zeitgeist thing, but whatever.
I mean, I guess it was just bound to happen.
Means to an end.
Yeah, sure. So then let's talk about the repeal, since this is for repeal day. So you might have guessed prohibition was pretty unpopular. Pretty unpopular. Prohibition was really bad for business, especially agriculture. The farmers, some of the farmers even were at one point in favor of prohibition. And then when it impacted them so severely and negatively economically, they were like, oh, shit, we gotta stop this. Like, we need, because as you've said in the past, one of the big reasons for growing crops is the production of booze.
Right.
There was a big push to repeal because the economy was in real trouble. This is like the depression's happening. Before the Volstead Act, 14% of the federal, state, and local tax revenue was derived from alcohol.
That's a lot.
So when the Great Depression hit, they really had to do something. So prohibition was repealed December 5th, 1933. But before they did that, they tried one more thing. On March 22nd, 1933, Roosevelt signed an amendment to the Volstead Act known as the Cullen-Harrison Act, which would allow the manufacture and sale of 3.2% alcohol by volume beer and light wines. The Volstead Act previously defined an intoxicating beverage as one with greater than 0.5% alcohol, which ain't a lot. Like, that you're gonna probably happen on that accidentally.
It's true.
And I think that leads into what you're gonna talk about. But before we do...
Oh yeah, we have another podcast that we want to let you know about.
Yeah, so this is a little sneak of the Ladies of Strange podcast.
Hello, friends. We are the Ladies of Strange. I'm Ashley.
I'm Tiffany.
And I'm Rebecca.
Have you ever wondered if Jenny's head really did fall off when they removed the green ribbon?
Or if aliens are hiding in the tails of comets waiting to take us away?
Or if there's any scientific basis to the Ouija board?
Well, then don't risk your search history and join us each Thursday as we discuss
the history, mystery, and theory
of all things questionable, odd, and eerie.
New episodes are released every Thursday. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. More information about the show, including show notes and links to our social media, can be found on our website, theladiesofstrange.com.
Keep it strange, lovelies.
So definitely check that out.
Yeah, I like occult stuff, weird paranormal stuff, true crime. I'm into all that.
How do we make
conspiracy theories?
Yeah, we need to find a crossover episode there.
We'll just do like haunted alcohol.
Haunted alcohol. Spirits and spirits.
Spirits and spirits. That's a good.
Yes. Great. You were talking about the Colin Harrison Act and that 3.2% beer thing, which was one of the rabbit holes which I went down in the research of Prohibition, was beer specific.
Ooh, I love rabbit holes. There's lots of bunnies down there.
There are. And these are beer bunnies.
Beer bunnies.
Yes. But yeah, so as you mentioned, we will have hopefully many repeal day and prohibition adjacent episodes to come. It's too much to cover in a short podcast, but I am going to cover this one little leg of it, which is the concept of near beer, where depending on what state in America you are listening from right now, if you're listening in America, this is a familiar term to you. And if you're listening outside of America, well, here's some goofy shit.
here's some goofy shit.
Yeah. All right.
Oh, those Americans and their antics.
Yeah. So you know, you're talking about 3.2% beer. To us, that sounds like a very light end beer nowadays.
For sure.
But the concept of low alcohol beer is not anything created by Prohibition, and it's not anything new. Low alcohol beer pretty much has been around pretty much since we've had beer. Pre-19th century, anywhere water was gross and dangerous. We've covered this, but one thing that I don't think I've specified is that before we understood that there were microbes in water, it's not like we knew like water made us sick. We just knew that fermented beverages made us healthier.
Oh.
Yeah, we hadn't quite drawn that connection, you know?
Right. Well, we didn't know. We couldn't see the microorganisms.
No. So it was just more of a commonly held belief, like there was a connection between robust people and the consumption of fermented beverages.
Okay.
So if you have like a sickly child, feed them beer. If your child's like doing all right, they can have water. It's fine.
Hey.
And I say child because we're talking like medieval times. Like people were drinking this, it was called small beer. It was basically like that beer porridge we talked about before.
The toddler beer.
Yes. And it's like in its earliest form, it was like a fermented bread porridge that had an alcohol content. You would consume it as your drink, children would, parents would, right, along with a meal. Oh, and the alcohol content of this was like 1 or 2%. It was very low.
Like nothing.
Yeah. And then breweries eventually got in on this action as we got more and more beer consumption. So what they would do is they would produce a small beer by like the third pass on a mash. Mm. So like the first pass on a mash would be like their strongest beer. They'd make another one that would be like a more like a mid-range beer. And then that last one would be brewed to like a 2-3% alcohol beer. So it was widely distributed, like, you know, breweries distributed it, monks made it. Small beer was a very popular, like, other option and wasn't viewed as, like, a thing that you got drunk on. It was just a thing that you drank throughout the day. It was,
you would have to drink a lot of that
and it was,
to get drunk.
Yeah.
That was your goal.
Well, and it was touted as, like, having all these health benefits. Mm. Ben Franklin even made his own small beer. He has a recipe out there somewhere. Some homebrewers make it to this day.
Somewhere.
He's got one. But yeah, throughout the 19th century, small beer, which is an added benefit, was often cheaper than regular beer, was consumed throughout the day by industrial workers and businessmen. It was just seen as a hearty, healthy drink of the common man. Now, moving forward to the 20th century, obviously beer got stronger and became less of a during-the-day drink. As you mentioned, other stronger spirits kind of came in for that. But it still is a cornerstone of the American identity. That's, of course, we're talking about Prohibition. That's where Prohibition comes in. So, President Woodrow Wilson, you know, as you mentioned, he did his best to appease the temperance movement. One of the first things he offered is to reduce the legal limit of alcohol of malt beverages to 2.75. That's kind of, we're gonna get into the study of not alcohol percentage, because we already had the tools to understand how much alcohol was in a drink at this point. What we didn't have was an understanding of, but how much could you have before you were intoxicated? And we're really, like, the way we study this is basically putting people in a room and letting them drink and then looking at them and being like, well, I can't do math. That's a bad thing.
Right. Because even, like, stature has a huge effect, like, your body weight.
Yeah,
has,
and it's, like, and it's not purely related to just, like, how tall are you, how much do you weigh. Like,
exactly.
It's all about your physiology.
Mm-hmm. And your tolerance.
Yeah. So we're still rough on all this stuff. That 2.75 number came from some studies at the time where it was basically like, oh, this is what you can drink a beverage at and you won't get too messed up to like function. But that didn't pass. Like you said, Prohibition, Volstead Act, beer was made illegal unless it had an alcohol content of under 0.5%.
Which is nothing.
That is nothing. And I mean, pre-Prohibition, there were thousands of breweries in America. Brewing beer was an American, like staple. And most of these wouldn't survive the Prohibition era. But those that did got creative.
Okay.
So some sold ice cream.
Resourceful.
Yeah.
Hey.
Anheuser-Busch, Yingling, PBR made cheese.
Aw.
Yeah.
They're making cheese.
There was PBR cheese that was made by Kraft for a while.
Oh, wow. Was it beer-flavored cheese?
No, it was just cheese. They just used their equipment, you know? Right, we're going to make ice cream. We're going to make cheese. We're going to get in on that dairy action.
All right.
This is one fact that I liked. A lot of breweries started making malt extract, which they would sell as like, it was a health additive and it was good for baking. Now, actually, people like would buy it and they'd use it to homebrew beer to the point that agents of like enforcing prohibition caught on to this and they tried to get malt extract like made illegal.
Oh.
Because so many people were using it to brew beer at home. And, you know, basically the court case was like, if people, whatever they want to do with it, it's not on the producer's fault. Right. So,
and prohibition didn't restrict your consumption at home.
Right.
So I guess it probably wouldn't have restricted your production at home if you're doing it privately and just making it for yourself.
Exactly. And I mean, it's, you know, I think that the breweries knew what they were doing. They knew exactly what they were providing. But it was just sort of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge of like, malt extract, great for your cupcakes.
Your cupcakes, yeah. Exactly. You want that, those malty cupcakes? We got you.
But of course, then they also just kept brewing their regular beer. They would just take an extra step to remove the alcohol. It was commercially referred to as cereal beer.
Could you pour it over your cereal?
No. Well, no, I don't think you should. But it was the name near beer caught on for
it. That's a little bit more palatable. I don't want to think about cereal.
Except for the actual names of these near beers are really funny. There was one brewed by Pabst, which was called Pablo.
Cute.
Miller brewed Vivo.
All right.
Anheuser-Busch brewed Bevo.
They all end with O?
I don't know why. And Schlitz made Famo. So I don't know what they were like. It was a pretty popular product. Maybe because people loved the watered-down cereal bubbles. Or maybe because a common practice at the time was to spike or needle your beer. Which literally meant injecting booze back into your beer. So you'd get some bootleg booze. Your beer at this point was like a mixer, and you would just make something that was like beer out of your underproofed beer and your bathtub horrible moonshine, whatever.
Yeah, was like, I'd had a thought for a second being like, well, why would you just drink the booze? But the booze was gross, so that's why.
So it, you know, people did drink it, but people also bought it as an illegal mixer, or as a mixer with illegal substances.
All right. I like their style.
Yeah. Now, the presidential race of 1932 was pretty much divided on a wet and dry line. Franklin Delano Roosevelt won handily as the wet candidate, or the candidate that wanted the country to go back to consuming alcohol.
The wet candidate.
It's true. He had a great platform. Yeah. Y'all want to get drunk? Me too.
Sounds sexy.
Yeah. He was the pro-repeal candidate, and he won. Now, repealing an amendment takes a minute.
Yeah.
So, as you mentioned, something he could do immediately is tinker with the legal limit of the alcohol content of beer. So that was his first 2 months of office. He passed that Cullen-Harrison Act. You said it was signed, what, March?
March 22nd.
March 22nd. So it went into effect on April 7th.
It takes time sometimes.
Yes. And that is his iconic quote, "I think this would be a good time for a beer," comes from this act.
Oh, that's so cute.
Yes. Do you want to do an accent? Are you going to do it?
"I think this would be a good time for beer."
Yeah, even now, April 7th is celebrated nationwide as National Beer Day. And like you said, that allowed beer up to 3.2%. Now, This specific number comes again from a kind of rough scientific study. This was a new study that was sponsored by breweries, so
might be a little biased.
Yes. But they paid a physiologist by the name of Anton Carlson to conduct a study on what percentage of beer could get you drunk. Now, like I said, he didn't really have great tools for measuring it. He just kind of let people drink and then studied the effects. And he had some loose grounds of operation. Basically, if you couldn't walk or think straight, that's when he decided you were drunk. Not before.
Not before.
Not before. So based on his argument, 3.2%, that number comes from his decision that this was the amount of beer that could be brewed naturally to that amount without any additional steps, and it would not get you wasted. Okay. Ever?
I feel like there are some people who would take that challenge.
I think so. But that's where that number is kind of like, you can drink this to excess and you won't get wasted. I definitely have seen people take that challenge.
Oh, yeah.
But the semantics didn't matter for long, though, because just a few months later, states were allowed to ratify the ability to sell alcohol of all strength, except some didn't. This was ratified state by state, and they had state laws still respected. So
some hangers-on.
Yeah, I mean, some states stayed dry for a long time, and maybe that eventually shrunk to dry counties and towns, but even to this day, we have dry towns and townships mm-hmm. in America.
And then there's a lot of places that are dry on Sundays.
Yeah, those are blue laws is what we call them, which is also something we should do a whole episode about, because blue laws are goofy as hell.
We'll do that. Goofy blue laws.
But the cool thing, the thing about the 3.2% law is that while some states kept it in place just to limit the readily available sale of high alcohol beers, there's a cool sort of study, if you look at Colorado, for how it used that law. Now, before the Drinking Age Act of 1984, the drinking age in America was set state by state. Now, that act raised it to 21. But before that, Colorado used the near beer, the 3.2 thing, to basically be a gateway beer. Like, you could buy that if you were 17, 18, 19, 20.
Okay.
And then you had to drink real alcohol, you had to be 21. And even after that, the way that law worked is it basically kept it out of any place that didn't have like a state-issued liquor license. So big corporations, I mean, Walmarts or Kmarts or whatever comes into your town, couldn't sell anything but 3.2% beer.
Mm.
And that did a couple things. It made the market for local beers, for higher octane craft beers in those areas, be like much more profitable, because you didn't get your regular percentage Millers and Buds, you got 3.2% beer.
Right.
And these other places that had liquor license could choose to sell that, or they could choose not to.
Right.
So they kind of used it to open the door for a proliferation of craft beers and a limitation of big corporate beers.
Hey, craft beer movement. Yeah.
Now, obviously some places didn't have this very creative use of the law. This isn't in the past. It won't actually be until in 2019 it's happened, but it won't be until 2020 that the 3.2 law will have fully left almost the entire American landscape. Until recently, Utah, Colorado, Kansas, and Oklahoma also had that in place, and Minnesota remains the last state on the books to keep the 3.2% beer law in place.
Oh, wow.
That doesn't mean you can't drink beer above 3.2%. It just means you have to have a liquor license to sell that.
So you just can't get it in the grocery store.
Yeah, you can't get it in the grocery store. You can't get it in a convenience store. Mm-hmm. You have to go to places that have liquor license, which in a state like Colorado, they made affordable. Colorado kind of used those laws to like raise your standards, maybe make you drink a little less, but also like promote more craft breweries. Other states just did it to kind of limit the ability to get higher alcohol beer easily. You had to go to the state store. Yeah, you had to go to places that were a bit more highly legislated.
Right.
Blue laws are crazy. But I do like that Colorado used it to just really help promote its craft breweries.
Hey, yeah. Colorado's usually got the right idea.
Yeah, like when I first read it, it was like, Colorado had the 3.2 law for a long time. It's like, until recently, I'm like, Colorado, really? Like, oh.
They were smart about it.
They were keeping like the big brews out, and I mean, not out, but highly legislated, and then mm-hmm. they were making their giant, amazing beers in their breweries and selling them in their bars and their, you know, liquor stores. But all of this kind of runs counter. I started talking about small beer as like a European thing. Of course, even today, I mean, and through the whole American history, low alcohol beers aren't considered a weird thing to consume mm-hmm. for the rest of the world. It's a funny concept to think about. Like, we kind of judge our alcohol in America as like, how strong is it? That's an important thing to consider in. Even the way we design cocktails, we base them around a basic idea of like how much alcohol ends up in the glass. And what I've encountered in other drinking cultures is that's not really a huge part of the consideration. I think because of the separation of like alcohol from like just a culinary thing you consume and going into the realm of like a sin, like something that's bad for you.
Yeah.
Like it creates this weird like mental divide where like, you know, this is what I'm paying for. I'm paying for this much booze. We don't think about that in terms of food. Like when I go out to eat, I'm like, if this doesn't have X amount of grams of fat, then I'm being cheated. Like that's what I agree to. We don't think about the content. We think about how much do we enjoy the taste? Do we enjoy like what we're having, what we're consuming? And I will say, as far as the near beer or the low alcohol movement, it's the same people that kind of fought against it and then like were the first to jump back, the craft beer brewers, are also now responding to that with like low alcohol beers, and even no alcohol beers are becoming a trend again.
Right. It took a long time, but I feel like America is kind of like the United States is kind of like a child that was like super sheltered and you sent them to like Catholic school just to like to make sure that they don't go bad, and then they're like, fuck you, mom. Like,
exactly. I would agree. I would agree. And now, hopefully, we're on that kind of like rebound where, you know, it kind of like clicked for me when I thought on this in terms of like, I don't eat meat. I'm not sad about it, but it does leave me out of certain cultural exchanges. But I would never think that if I went to a restaurant with friends that was like, this is a steakhouse, I'm like, oh, they have a salad. It's all I eat the salad. Then my friends would be like, what is the thing they specialize here is meat. I'm like, great, but I don't eat that.
Yeah.
Like, it wouldn't be weird. It would be weirder for them. I mean, there are definitely people out there that would be weird about you not eating meat at a steakhouse. But like, when we think of it in culinary terms,
right,
and like just, I don't consume this, that doesn't like put me outside of something. But drinking is very much still a thing where it's like, you don't do it like... it's a culture, and it's a culture you're missing out on. And the rest of the world doesn't have that divide. It's like, you could have a low alcohol beer. You could have a high alcohol beer. You could have a drink. We don't like drink it during the day, drink it at night.
Care.
Don't drink at all. Like it's a bit more of a lax view. It's just something, if you enjoy it, you should consume it.
Right. The rest of the world is kind of like the parent that was like, yeah, like go play in the yard. Like it's like the not the helicopter parent that that the U.S. government was.
Exactly.
So, like, that kid is not as rebellious because they don't have anything to rebel against.
Well, and I think that that's, you know, like, that's... it's a hard argument to get into when you say, like, well, does that mean that it needs regulation? Like, you brought up the good point. Like, people were super drunk back then, and now they're less so. But is that because we learned how to better regulate and inform people? At the time, we didn't have... people didn't understand what they were consuming. It's like saying, like, well, if we didn't... like we didn't know the dangers of cigarettes, so now that people know them, a more informed body can choose not to smoke.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't really apply the same logic to people that smoked back before we had studies, because they didn't know.
Exactly.
So I don't know. It's an interesting conversation, really, when you look at it on a world scale. Like, our attitudes towards drinking and our way of thinking about alcohol content is an important quality and something you consume. Whereas the rest of the world is just like, that's just a factor. It affects the taste. It affects how many you can have. Like, it's all the same as, like, you can eat, you know, 10 French fries. Maybe you don't eat 10 steaks. Like, it's just the content is different. Like, it's like there's moderation and as part of every other form of consumption.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't quite. We're getting there.
I don't know if America knows about moderation.
Well, I think it's like we didn't get to have this now. So I get to have it. You can't tell me no. Like. Hopefully we're getting past that. I'm encouraged by like craft breweries brewing like 3% beers and they're 4% beers. Like a lot of prominent breweries, even like session beers is a thing now.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's cool because we're recognizing, oddly enough, like even kombucha kind of helps that along because kombucha has a little alcohol in it. Nobody drinks kombucha to get drunk, and I don't think you ever should.
That'd be a little bit too much for your tummy.
Like a tummy ache. But that idea of like you can enjoy the palate that fermentation brings to a drink.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to purely exist just to get intoxicated. Anybody listening outside of America, I think, I mean, depending on the culture, that might seem like a no shit, but like I feel like still to our kind of collective unconscious of the nation, that's still something that we're like, but I want to know that this is right. going to get me drunk. But yeah. I do think it's an important point. When we talk about prohibition, I don't want to fall on the side of like, yeah, everybody should get wasted, or like, nobody should. I think it's that our relationship with alcohol was interrupted and we have a lot of like unhealthy relationships with it because of that.
Yeah.
That hopefully culturally we're moving past. So yeah, over on the video, we're going to make you two classic Prohibition era cocktails. We're going to make you something good that if you want to have a last minute repeal day party, you can have these along with us.
Yeah, exactly. I just want to say thank you to all of you who donated to our Patreon and all of our new Patreon members. If you want to hop on that, it's a really good time because we are coming out with some videos for some really nice cocktail syrups that you can use in a cocktail or in your coffee or however you want to use that, but they're exclusive to the Patreon, and so literally you could give us any amount of money and see those videos. We're gonna have some cool stuff for you, so it's a really good time to join the Patreon. If you want to be one of our Patreon supporters, we will put the link in our show notes. Thank you to everybody who tweeted and retweeted about the show this week. It really helps us get the word out. I'm not sure who that is because we are recording a little bit in advance, so just thank you so much. Thank you. I will shout you out next week. Thank you to Absurdist for our wonderful theme music. Thank you to Ladies of Strange for doing that promo swap with us. You can go listen to them on anywhere you get your podcast. If you're listening on iTunes, please subscribe and give us a review if you like. And don't forget to head over to our YouTube channel. We're going there right now.
I have been Taylor Smurl.
I've been Liz June.
And this has been
Neat.